Hello, I'm Dr. Scott Wattier.
And I'm Tommy Welling, and you're listening to the Fasting for Life podcast.
This podcast is about using fasting as a tool to regain your health, achieve ultimate wellness, and live the life you truly deserve.
Each episode is a short conversation on a single topic with immediate actionable steps. We cover everything from fat loss and health and wellness to the science of lifestyle design.
We started Fasting for Life because of how fasting has transformed our lives, and we hope to share the tools that we have learned along the way. Hey everyone, welcome to the Fasting for Life podcast. My name is Dr. Scott Wattier, and I am here as always with my good friend and colleague, Tommy Welling. Good afternoon to you, sir.
Hey, Scott, how are you?
Doing fantastic. I think today is going to be a monumental episode.
Oh, wow.
So now that I've put that out there, we have to deliver, so no pressure. And this might be a multiple episode article that we've kind of stumbled across, but I think it probably has that much potential for impact and maybe uncovering some of the inadequacy of the understanding of what it is that we're dealing with when we talk about blood sugar and health related conditions related to blood sugar. So with that, that was a mouthful. I'm excited to kind of start uncovering this and unpacking it so people can kind of peek behind the curtain, so to speak.
Yeah, me too. And I love the history behind this. So what we're going to be diving into and how long this question has been around, and what we've already discovered and what we're quote unquote rediscovering, and how it's applicable to today, and how the problems keep getting worse, but even though the solutions have been discovered a long time ago.
Yeah, I know when I was growing up, and this is probably a weird analogy, but neon was a big thing, right? So in the 80s, late 80s, early 90s, neon, checkerboard, slip-on shoes, like,
yeah,
all that stuff. Well, neon's come back around. So everything seems to be cyclic, and some of the stuff that we're going to talk about today was once very widely accepted. And then we'll talk about how the potential that big food, big pharma, and you know in the agricultural boom, the industrial revolution, all that kind of stuff that happened over the years, has kind of led us to a point where we're not really treating the cause of the problem, but we're really kind of keeping the agreed upon metrics, so to speak, between the field goalposts. If we end up in between this range for this individual, then we've achieved a health metric, that will be good for the individual. And that's just not true. The outcome, and we'll get into the details here. I don't want to be too abstract, but the outcome is not a better health metric or a better outcome for the patient. It's actually a worsening and a increasing of the comorbidities and other things that can happen. And it's incredible that in the age of information that we have and the access that we have to it, there's still this kind of almost blindness to it where I don't really understand, other than maybe going down a rabbit hole of done on purpose almost. Like, how can people not realize that this is the way that should be used, yet the opposite mechanisms have been being used? So I want to lay it out kind of linearly if we can, but I think it's going to be hopefully encouraging to people that have been struggling and not understanding why you can't get the results when you have blood sugar related issues.
Yeah, I think that'll be good because we get to, you know, peel back the layers of the onion a little bit and start getting to the crux of the matter. And you know, because we've talked about in the past, in a bit of a state of the union kind of way, the problems with obesity and blood sugar and diabetes and all the comorbidities, and but getting to where, you know, almost like how did we get to this spot, like where we are today, where did the recommendations come from, how were the treatments designed, and what's the end goal of them, and why do some people feel like they've been struggling for decades and can't seem to gain any sort of control or traction, right?
Yeah, and it really came from just the basis of one of the things that we teach and that our lives have been transformed by, which is this concept of insulin resistance and the insulin-friendly lifestyle. So I was coming across a tweet the other day by an MD. His name is Dr. Eli Jaroug. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly, but He had a post where it was like, just really linear thinking, and too much insulin equals obesity. Too much insulin for too long results in insulin resistance, which then is pretty much diabetes, type 2 diabetes. Mm-hmm. Too much insulin can also result in salt retention, which can result in high blood pressure. Too much insulin can result in high triglyceride levels and high cholesterol. And too much insulin can even put your body into a grow and divide pathway, which can increase your certain cancer risks, et cetera.
Right.
So we're looking at that. And then the article we're actually going to be kind of reviewing and pulling from is out of the Journal of Clinical Investigation. This was part of a review series where it's the 100th anniversary of insulin's discovery. So insulin was discovered 100 years ago, and this panel of docs went back and looked at, you know, the title is Carbohydrate Restriction for Diabetes, Rediscovering Centuries Old Wisdom. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting, the timeline of what used to be accepted to where we are now, and how far away from that concept that the discovery of insulin and the application of the use of insulin has really fueled the problem and put gasoline on the fire, so to speak, rather than actually getting to the cause of blood sugar related issues and insulin resistance.
Yeah. Almost like whenever technology or discovery kind of almost becomes an enabling kind of situation where we found a solution to an issue, or we found a way to somehow control it, which was, you know, a huge technological and medical breakthrough at the time. And it still is. But at the same time, it allowed for enabling, lifestyle things and diets and habits that were known to actually help with the issue. Like the article leads off with, low carbohydrate lifestyles have been used for the last 300 years to prolong the lives of diabetic patients. But with the discovery of insulin, those same diets kind of fell out of favor. They became less popular because they didn't feel like they were as needed anymore.
Yeah, and that was one of the most eye-opening things. When looking at kind of the timeline, so to speak, the ADA guidelines and how they've changed over the years, and how in the 70s they went to that more low fat, higher carb. But what they've realized, one of the things that's in here is the high carbohydrate diet is how they refer to it. And that's the prevailing dietary pattern in the US, consistent with the recent recommendations for people with diabetes and the USDA recommendations for the general public. And that's greater than 45% of your carbohydrate daily intake coming from carbohydrates, meaning greater than 225 grams per deciliter of carbs in any given day. And it never used to be that way. Back before the advent of insulin, there was a high dependent or a high success rate, and it was the accepted treatment protocol for people that had blood sugar related issues or diabetes to be on a low carbohydrate diet, which was, a medical nutritional therapy.
Right.
Where then, as we've progressed through the decades, and we're not going to hit all of the exit ramps right on this timeline, but as things progressed, the creation of insulin, the acceptance of insulin then led to this idea that, especially when it became commercial, that diabetes patients didn't have a lifestyle induced issue and they could live more normally, air quotes, right? So like, I know you can see me, but air quotes normally, mm-hmm. and it relaxed the food monitoring, right? And then 25 years later, combine that with a flood of processed convenient snacks and cereals and juices and mainstream marketing, in the 1950s, the grocery stores just exploded. In the 1970s, those ADA guidelines, where it's low fat, higher carb, mm-hmm. Is going to be heart healthy or heart protective. And you've got the heart healthy label. Yeah. The little check mark. Yeah, exactly. That's where I was going, which, by the way, they just pay for.
Yeah, you can buy them. You can get like a group discount if you have a bunch of products.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. Right. So we're not, I don't want to go down that rabbit hole, but yeah, I don't want to be, you know, in the show notes, we'll be like conspiracy. No, I mean, it's a real thing. You can just go look it up. So, right. But the problem is that, you know, again, you weren't addressing the underlying issue. You started, it's almost like having the answers to the test. So you had this complex problem that, you know, was then, you know, turned into a bigger problem when insulin became the standard bearer, or standard treatment protocol, when other forms of lifestyle management or other medications didn't get the result. You ended up in this place where you were cheating the system because you were using insulin to drive the blood sugars down, which is a natural process. But when you have resistance, that process doesn't work as efficiently as it should. Mm-hmm. So we have, you know, the problem of the misguided recommendations with the commercially available insulin, which allowed people to kind of, I don't know if it, I mean, I'm assuming it wasn't intentional, but to just kind of sit back and be like, no, it's okay. I don't really need to make these changes because we have this stopgap that's going to save my life. And that's the complete actual opposite of what happens. Because we know that when you have diabetes, that you have a higher risk of heart issues, which is like one of the number one comorbidities when you're not correcting the disease, but merely managing it.
Correct. Right. And, you know, I thought it was really interesting. In the article, it said in 1979 that the ADA guidelines were revised. They revised the goal of dietary management from avoiding deleterious metabolic derangements. So they were trying to avoid issues with actual metabolism. And they switched it to maintaining plasma glucose as near to the normal physiologic range as possible. So they changed the endpoint. They changed where the goalpost was. And insulin is exactly what allows, you know, a patient or a provider to be looking towards that particular goalpost, because insulin is generally administered to actually control what the plasma glucose levels read. But the problem is then that takes the complete focus on what the insulin levels are, and also what's causing the issue, being the lifestyle changes that were so readily accepted beforehand, and then almost were allowed to kind of go by the wayside and become much less popular after insulin became readily available.
And one of the things that was really interesting is that, you know, some of the investigation in this article, you know, over the last 100 years, you know, nutritionally, we went from carb restriction to just, you know, like you just mentioned, carb overload, right? Mm-hmm. Fiber was a savior at one point. And then we've got also, you know, the insulin therapy and how that's, you know, so-called improved over the years, because now we have rapid acting insulin and long acting insulin and different ways to kind of, you know, split the baby, so to speak, where you're like, well, if this isn't working, we can use this, you know, this modality, and try to stabilize those blood sugar numbers. And the point I'm getting at here is over the years, the focus has gone from medical nutritional therapy. So pure like lifestyle, medical nutrition, like here is what you need to do to reverse this process or not let it progress, or actually literally like increase your lifespan and increase your quality of life.
Right.
To an emphasis on pharmacotherapy and technology. And there's been some benefit with the technology, meaning, for instance, insulin is extremely important for type 1 diabetics. Like it is a requirement or else that person will not survive.
Right.
Benefit. Not a benefit for type 2 diabetics. And on top of that, you know, insulin pumps, type 1 diabetics, hugely important, because you can get real-time data and real-time insulin release to keep that person within a safe blood sugar range. Mm-hmm. Constant glucose monitors, those have been, you know, hugely impactful, because now you have real-time data every 15 minutes throughout the day, you can get a blood sugar reading.
Yeah.
So there's a benefit for the technology part of how we've gone from emphasis on nutrition therapy, medical nutritional therapy, and, you know, in the 1920s to where we are now, which is, you know, on pharmacotherapy, which really isn't beneficial for the long-term health of the patient.
Yeah. And, you know, it wasn't very long ago that people didn't have access to, you know, a glucose test. They couldn't walk around, like I couldn't pull my Keto Mojo out of my pocket and get a blood sugar and a ketone reading, you know, within, right, within 2 minutes. Right. But if I was needing to take insulin and I was told to keep my blood sugar, you know, below 100 or 110, whatever I'm being told, that's my goalpost. That's what I'm aiming for. And with that feedback from the technology, if I see that I'm within that range because I'm administering the insulin, then I'm getting positive feedback on the complete wrong thing, because I could be maintaining the poor lifestyle choices to further the problem, to further the disease, and to shorten my lifespan while being told that I'm hitting the right marks and that I'm hitting the numbers I need to be. That's the problem, right?
Yeah. And one of the crazy, I mean, Dr. Jason Fung, who, you know, one of the books that we both read early on in our fasting journey, had mentioned, he's like, he realized that when he was treating, and obviously this is not a direct quote from him, but I remember him talking about in his stories he was telling in his book, he'd be treating his patients. And when he was a nephrologist and, you know, patients on dialysis, et cetera, and he'd be treating his patients, realizing that like, they're not getting any better. Like, right, they're actually getting worse. So that was one of the reasons why he pivoted and now has been doing the intensive diabetes management system and all this other stuff that he's created over the years. But, yeah, you know, the crazy take home for me was, you know, when I'm thinking through this is like, high carb diets became popular, but not because of the superiority of the evidence. Hmm. Like, that's why I was talking about early on in the vague nature that I said it, where it was like, okay, we have to look in the mirror here and be like, okay, what are the results, you know, of the practices that we've been doing, and why in the first place were they ever changed?
Hey everyone, I want to tell you about an incredible company called Air Doctor Pro. You can go to airdoctorpro.com, use the promo code FASTINGFORLIFE to receive up to $300 off one of their amazing air filters. By supporting them, you're supporting us and this show. I want to tell you an incredible testimony. We now know that the indoor air is 2 to 5, sometimes up to 100 times more polluted than the outdoor air, according to the EPA. And my son has been struggling with sleep. He hasn't slept. He's over 2 years old. He hadn't slept through the night his entire life. My wife and I had done everything. We could not figure it out. We put an Air Doctor Pro in his room, and I am not kidding. The first night he slept through the night, he went over 30 nights in a row for the first time ever sleeping through the night. We don't know what it did or what was in the air, because we've had our house tested. But whatever it's doing is allowing him to rest and sleep peacefully for the first time. And for that, it is absolutely priceless. Air Doctor Pro comes with a 30-day breathe-easy money-back guarantee. So if you don't love it, just send it back for a refund. Minus shipping, head to airdoctorpro.com. Use the promo code FASTINGFORLIFE to receive up to $300 off any of their air purifiers. Exclusive to podcast customers, you'll also receive a free 3-year warranty on any unit, which is an additional $84 value. Lock in the special offer by going to airdoctorpro.com. Use the promo code Fasting for Life.
Yeah, that's a good point. And if we can kind of zoom out, especially, you know, if I'm currently, you know, suffering from any of you know, insulin related issues, if I'm zooming out and take a look at the history of where we are and where we kind of came from, that can give me a bit of perspective on why I might be kind of aiming towards the wrong goalpost, so to speak. Right.
Yeah. Some of this stuff came from the misunderstanding of, you know, type 1, type 2 diabetes over the years, and the misunderstanding of what nutritional ketosis versus ketoacidosis is. So I know some of this stuff was insulated around, like, trying to obviously make the right decision for the health and the life, literally the life of the patient in type 1 diabetes situations. But right. Now we have a much better understanding of those effects, right? So one of the outcomes of this for me is like, okay, well, the economic burden of diabetes in the US right now in 2017 was $327 billion, and $15 billion of that was specifically for insulin. And that can be up to $800 a month for someone to be requiring insulin. And if you've known anyone that's on insulin in the type 2 diabetes world, they're typically very health compromised, you know. Right. From my personal experience, we've had runs in the family, the heart attacks, the cardiovascular disease, obesity, obviously, you know, the excess weight has issues, the high blood pressure, the high cholesterol. But one of the easiest things we could do then is, you know, go back to the old tried and true nutritional recommendations of decreasing the carbohydrate intake, increasing your insulin sensitivity, which is how well your insulin works that you have in your bloodstream, and how well your body is producing it, how much it's producing, and then how well it's acting actually to remove the sugar. But if you have less sugar in your body or less carbohydrate intake, then you have less need for the insulin, which gives that body an opportunity to repair. And it's just crazy to me that, you know, there was no superiority in the use of insulin for long-term outcomes. And we know that insulin could reduce that risk that I referred to, you know, when there wasn't a good understanding of the actual disease processes or the keto versus ketoacidosis.
Right.
So it could reduce those acute effects of the carbohydrate consumption. So that high and that low that can be like life-threatening. But now, like the majority of the time when we talk to clients or we have people send us messages, they're not told any of this. They're just told you have to make sure you stick to your diet plan because you have to worry about low blood sugar, right? Hypoglycemia is only, or ketoacidosis on the other end of the spectrum is only a concern when you're over-medicating or in the case of type 1 diabetes. So the encouragement here is that if you are on the spectrum of prediabetes, you know, weight loss retention, weight loss resistance, excuse me, you see your family and friends and coworkers, you know, around you. You know, for me, it was my dad's uncles, my family, my grandparents, where, you know, I could just see the effects of this. It's like, okay, well, yeah, it's great. We have an HbA1c now to track these over the last 90 days. But having an HbA1c in a normal range, taking insulin and a bunch of other medications for things that could simply be fixed by removing the source makes no sense to me.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just serving to further the problem without getting to the crux of the matter. But you know, with all of these historical points and kind of seeing the timeline, being able to zoom out like this, I think it really sheds some light on kind of where we came from and why we could be, you know, aiming at the wrong goalpost still today, even though, you know, despite more information than ever, despite better technology than ever, and yet still we find ourselves getting sicker and then asking ourselves, well, why and what can we do about it?
Yeah. And I think maybe one of the points of clarification too is that you and I lived this. We were on this path, right? Mm-hmm. And then I had my dad to look at and say, okay, well, he's already there. Well, now he's off all his he's off like 13 medications in the last 6 months, right? He's lost 60 plus pounds. He's no longer a diabetic.
Great.
Right? But he was at the point where he was on insulin, 100 plus units of insulin a day. What do you think his quality of life was like? Well, I know it was crap. I know he had headaches. I know his energy was, down the drain, like sleep was an issue, like just, you know, mood swings. Even I know I suffered from some of that in my mid-30s, you know, from the insulin spikes and the insulin resistance that I had. So the encouraging thing here is that we have now with this 100 years of looking back to see kind of where we've lost our way. And one of the motivating factors that you and I have talked about, Tommy, is the fact that from a financial standpoint, this is an epidemic. Like, you know, we're talking about billions of dollars to not even see improvement. So those costs are only going to go up, being obese, having diabetes, et cetera. So when you and I started this, we're like, let's turn on the microphones and tell our story. Well, what we didn't realize is that maybe in the beginning, it was like, all right, I want to tell the story because I want to help people like us. But what I'm realizing is that the diabetes epidemic, because of its relationship to other health metrics and poor health outcomes, could literally transform the health, never not just here in the United States, but of the country. And now I'm even more motivated than I was 12 months ago, you know, tossing around the idea of talking into a microphone with you.
Yeah.
Of like, everybody at least needs to hear this. And even if this is just the first step into the rabbit hole, like just thinking about it differently, rather than treating the symptom, getting to the underlying cause and actually taking the responsibility back into your own hands, rather than relying on pharmacology and technology, let's go back to, you know, the old guard, so to speak, and just look through the lens that, you know, maybe there is another way. and be open to it, because you can always go on the medication, but let's never let you get there in the first place.
Right. You don't have to go down that path. Even if a lot of people, you know, kind of were led down the wrong direction, it doesn't have to continue, right? Like we can make a turn, we can make an exit off the highway at any point.
Right.
You know?
Right. And I see it being an uphill battle, right? Because you've got, you know, the pharmaceutical companies, you've got the medical institutions, the medical field is being consolidated, like hospitalist groups, and mm-hmm. the small little doctor's office, you know, especially here in Houston, is going away. You know, out in the rural areas, yeah, of course, you'll have the local family doc that, you know, kind of does everything from, you know, possibly saving a horse's life one day to delivering a baby the next, if you're out like right. in the middle of nowhere, right? Like,
and they did it for a bushel of corn too, right?
Right, right. That still exists. But, you know, where we are, you know, you're seeing that going away. So the consolidation, in my opinion, being in clinical practice and then being on also the insurance side of things, is it's almost gotten out of control, right? In terms of, wow. you know, looking at cost here in the United States too. So we're up against that. Then we're up against the convenience and ease and engineering, chemical engineering of our food supply, right?
Right.
So we're really stressing our willpower. Our system seems to be a little backwards. And then, you know, trying to figure out this information on your own is extremely overwhelming. So mm-hmm. where do we start? Well, we start with the basics. Controlling your insulin response is really simple. And that's why we believe fasting is the number one place to start. If you have weight loss resistance, you've done the yo-yo, you've put on and lost that 20 to 40 pounds, you've got 100 pounds to lose, you know you're pre-diabetic. Yes, reducing carbohydrates is going to be a huge part in that, but also increasing that time in between your meals is going mm-hmm. to accelerate that healing process.
Yeah, that's going to be the only way that your body's going to be able to drop the insulin levels low enough to give the cells time to recalibrate and to become more insulin sensitive. And so, and you know, if you're having trouble because you feel like you're on an island, you're alone with it, or you don't have, you know, somebody else to talk to about fasting or insulin friendly lifestyles, then that's why we started a free community on Facebook, right? Like,
yep.
Join the community and you know, get involved with the conversation. You know, you'll see a lot of really, really cool, inspiring stories. People really kind of you know, putting their lives out there a little bit and sharing them and giving some good feedback and just a great community that's growing.
Yeah. And if you're on Facebook, so that's just search Fasting for Life Community. And then there's a couple of questions. You answer the questions. We'll admit you into the group. And then it's a small community because we've just started out doing this, right? So mm-hmm. we've had, you know, a much greater impact in how many people have heard the podcast. But, you know, only such a small percentage, even though it's probably dozens a week at this point now, replying to emails and Facebook messages and comments yeah. on our podcast posts and all that. But being in the group will get you in an area where there's like-minded people. And there's a bunch of fasting groups out there, you know, fasting groups that have hundreds of thousands of people there on Facebook. Mm-hmm. I believe that we're doing something a little bit differently in that we want to keep it conversational. We want to keep it intentional, meaning if you have a question, go to the group. If you're not seeing the answer or getting the support you're needing, then reach out to us. info@thefastingforlife.com, info@thefastingforlife.com. And then the last place you could is we are going to be doing 8 of these challenges this year. So we've committed to doing 8 of the 10-day fasting, guided fasting ramp up challenges, right? And we're about to start one here on the 28th. Mm-hmm. I know you guys have been hearing a lot about the challenges recently. We just did an hour podcast about the year in review of, like, we didn't expect full transparency. I did not expect to do more than 1 or 2 challenges last year, but the results and the demand and the waiting list has been just incredible. So it's like, okay, well, if this is a way to get people results and wins, then we're just going to keep doing it. So I know, you've heard a lot about the fasting. We're in the middle of one right now. If you guys have interest in it, then, you know, shoot us a message, let us know. We're also going to be, you know, really working on getting some more tools into your hands over the first quarter of this year. Mm-hmm. In terms of, yeah, some guides and some, you know, some resources and digital resources and stuff as well. So, the challenge is always kind of our home base right now, because that's where we get to interact with, you know, 30, 40, 50 people at a time, and we get to see the transformation take place. So just really cool stuff. And please, 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 if you have not yet, go and add yourself to the Fasting for Life community. And we hope to continue to provide value and add support there as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Cool. All right, Tommy, anything else? I think we got that one. I'm hoping.
I think that's a really good one. I think the conversation is going to continue on that. And I love the perspective. I just love the fact that we can kind of see where we came from and where we're going, and yep. You know, make some corrections along the way too.
It's interesting. We didn't talk about fasting until the very end.
Right. And we'll put the link for the article and for the Facebook community in the show notes as well.
Cool. Yep. Yep. So if you're wondering where to go, we want you to have an action step. Go to the Facebook community. If you're already there and you haven't gotten our Fast Start Guide yet, go to our website, download the Fast Start Guide. That'll show you how to put one meal a day eating windows into your day-to-day life. Super simple. It's 6 steps. We walk you through exactly what to do and how to do it. If you've got questions, reach out. Tommy, as always, thank you, sir. And we'll talk soon.
Thank you. All right. Bye.
So you've heard today's episode and you may be wondering, where do I start? Head on over to thefastingforlife.com and sign up for our newsletter, where you'll receive fasting tips and strategies to maximize results and fit fasting into your day-to-day life.
While you're there, download your free Fast Start Guide to get started today. Don't forget to subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Make sure to leave us a 5-star review, and we'll be back next week with another episode of Fasting for Life.